Let's begin with a little introduction that's not really mentioned in the syllabus, and this has to do with the question, why bioethics in adult Sunday school? Why do we want to have such a topic? And I think there are a couple of reasons, and the first one, and they both are interrelated, but the first has to do with what I have noticed over the last maybe decade, really probably throughout my entire ministry, this tendency has been there, but it seems to be more pronounced recently. And that is a tendency to believe that the Bible has answers, black and white answers, to everything. And I'd like to say that that's not true, and it is actually quite a dangerous idea that it has black and white answers to everything. First of all, the Bible does not speak about everything. It speaks about the relationship between God and his people and his redemption in Jesus Christ. Now, people who are redeemed have wisdom from the Bible so that it applies to everything in life because we have to live our lives in God's world. But it doesn't mean that the Bible reveals to us how to do pencil sketching or how to take care of dental health. It doesn't reveal those things. Those are revealed through general revelation, which is accessible to all people. And so the Bible just does not give us, and it doesn't give us a foreign policy that our government should be following. It does not give us a political theory. It tells us simply to obey the existing civil magistrate, whoever that may be, in whatever system it may have. Secondly, it is not black and white, even on the things that it does address. And that's one of the things that I love about this book, that is David is not afraid to be nuanced on very controversial issues. He takes a strong stand where he believes the Bible is absolutely clear. And where it's not, he calls for wisdom and he backs off and doesn't want to be dogmatic where he is not certain that the Bible is dogmatic. And so even in applying absolutes, we may find that there are going to be different ways to apply an absolute. So the value of human life is absolute in Scripture. And yet we know, for example, that capital punishment is to be applied according to a number of places in the Bible for capital crimes. And so human life is valuable, and precisely because it's valuable, the taking of human lives that are criminal in that way is legitimate. Take something that's more relevant to our topic here with ethics is someone who is dying of cancer, they have a serious case of cancer, let's say it's stage 3 cancer, and the question is, should they pursue maximum treatment, chemo and radiation, the whole thing to the hilt, or not? And so there's not an absolute answer to that, because someone who is 91, has no dependents, does not feel that they have responsibilities in their lives that are the same as a 40-year-old mother with 6 children is going to come to a different position on that, or might come to a different position depending on the circumstances. And so we're going to see that there are just not black and white answers to everything. One of the things that I love in the book of Proverbs is this statement, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. And then it says, what sounds contradictory but really isn't, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So let's say the fool is raging at you. Well, it's you don't rage back at him because he's not going to listen to you, and raging is usually sinful. On the other hand, if the fool is being foolish in his logic and you can show him where his logic is foolish, then that's something that you ought to do. And so applying wisdom is a very important thing. And a friend of mine, T. David Gordon, some of you know him, and he has actually been working for years and taught in this adult Sunday school back in the late 90s a course on models for Christian ethics. And Dr. Gordon, I think, has done a great service. I will be happy when he publishes it, because I think it will be a wonderful companion to this book. And David Van Drunen knows about Dr. Gordon's work. But he distinguishes among five models that he believes are biblical, and I agree with him, for Christian ethics. And law, you see, is only one of them. So, and what I think we tend to do as Reformed Christians is we're so excited to see that God does give us ethical guidance in His Word. He does give us ethical absolutes. We're so excited to see that, that we latch on to law as if that's the only model for doing ethics. And so if you read the book of Proverbs, of course, you quickly see that wisdom, the ability to apply the knowledge of the doctrines of the Word of God, is required. And there are a lot of issues that are just not black and white. They're wisdom issues. They take a whole bunch of different factors into account in making a decision. Who should I marry? Where should I live? What kind of jobs should I pursue? Which college should I go to? All those sorts of questions require biblical wisdom. And then there is the communion model. Our communion with God is clear in Scripture that communing with the Lord through the means of grace gives us ethical motivation and teaches us what pleases God. And then the imitation model, imitating the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul says this a number of times, to imitate me even as I imitate Jesus. And there we have many clear examples in the New Testament in particular. And then the martial model, the model of Christian warfare, that this enters into our ethical understanding. And I don't have time and don't want to go into all of these in detail. We might even add a sixth, which is the way that being a pilgrim in this world relates to ethics. But the point here is that we don't have black and white answers to everything, and we're going to learn how then do we answer these very difficult questions of bioethics because of the intrusion or the new dimension of ethics that technologies have added. They've added to the kinds of questions that we need to be asking and answering in our lives as Christians. And so another broader reason why this is such a good book and such a good topic is that even though we're going to be focusing on beginning of life and end of life issues in terms of our ethical questions and reasoning, we're going to learn how to apply theology and Christian virtue to all ethical questions. And so it has a very broad application. And so those would be the two reasons interrelated that we're going to be studying bioethics together. Now, of course, ethics is not new to the church. It's been there ever since God began communicating with His people in the Garden of Eden. How we are to live before God in His world has always been a very important area of study for believers. But now bioethics has become it's a whole new area of ethics that secular people as well as Christians are intensely interested in, because there are so many new treatments. There's so much new scientific and medical knowledge out there and ability. And we're thankful for that, because the promise for treating all kinds of diseases and problems that human beings have physically is wonderful. And yet at the same time, there is a downside. And one of my basic arguments with technology in general is that we are so enthusiastic about our ability to make new things and to do new things and solve problems in new ways as Americans, that, or maybe even in the Western world generally, that we don't stop to ask, what is the downside? Is there a dehumanizing aspect or potential to various technologies? And so take just one example, the genetic or genome map of the human physical system is wonderful in terms of being able to spot, and of course we're learning more and more. We know now that the terrain is out there. It's sort of like discovering that the earth is round. We know now that the earth is round. There's this tremendous complex genetic code in our physical natures. But we don't know. Some people make some foolish claims about it, of course. They say things like, you know, that certain ethical behaviors are actually caused genetically. There's absolutely no proof, and I don't believe can be proof for that. But and we'll cure certain diseases if we can just open up stem cell research. You know, you've heard this kind of claim. And in fact, we are just scratching the surface of genetic research, but we can begin to tell, to predict certain inherited diseases. That's a good thing. But on the other hand, we have the prospect of designer babies, and that would be a dehumanizing dimension. So just some of those ambiguities that technology has brought into the ethical picture makes it a very complicated business. And as Christians, we, of course, realize that our ethics and the ethics of the secular world don't completely match up. And in fact, in some cases, when it comes to something like abortion, our ethics don't match up at all. They are in dramatic conflict with one another. What are some of the reasons that Christians tend to want black and white answers? I'm now looking for some good reasons why we tend to gravitate towards the black and white kinds of answers it's either right or wrong. What is it there out in the culture in which we live that would tend to make us want black and white answers? Yeah, Lori? It's simple. That's right. Yeah, actually, that was not something I had written down, but that's an excellent answer. It's simple. So, I mean, and there is, you know, I think that is a sign of Christian immaturity. We want everything to be simple, clear, black and white. We don't have to struggle thinking and praying about it and conversing with the church about it. So that would be one thing. It's easy in a society which is hostile to your basic belief system, and in our case, it's relativism in our culture. There are many who believe that ethics is only what I think is right or wrong. And so in reacting to that, we'll have a tendency to want all things to be black and white. And then you could add to this that the complexity that technology has now added to our ethical questions and decision making. So I can remember, in fact, when Robin's dad was on life support, suddenly we got brought into a room. I can remember sitting there with a doctor, an ethicist, and it was at CMC, so I knew that there was some real belief in absolute truths, and that was my first acquaintance with how complex this question was, because 50 years before, we didn't have the kinds of life support systems that would keep someone alive, and yet someone who really was unconscious in a coma and not really going to come out of that coma. So it's because of the complexity of that we would like black and white answers. And I think what we'll see in our course is that there are black and white answers. There are things that we know are true. So we know that life in the womb is human life and must be protected, and to kill that life is to go against the sixth commandment. Ron.
Yes, the other thing is culturally conditioned by the electronic media to just sit there without thinking and just accept the 3-second sound bites of tell me what to do, and so there's no critical thought. So that kind of relates back to the simplicity that someone mentioned as a first answer.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That that we live in a world where simple answers are being given all the time, and sometimes simple answers to very complex questions, and they really are not adequate answers, but we live under the illusion that they are answers. So, yes, thank you, Ron. That's an excellent point. And so, you know, he gives some examples here on page 13. He says that Christians know that there are boundaries, for example, in seeking, if you're infertile and you're seeking to have children, there are definite, many different ways that that can be done today. And so Christians would say, that's wonderful, but at the same time, it may be that there will be complications to that process. There are all kinds of things that can happen, a multiple fertilization. There might even be, you know, as many as five or six babies that are created by this. There are all kinds of ethical questions. There are character questions that have to be asked. And so the point is that there are no simple answers. And the other thing now that he is going to talk about in terms of the purpose of his book on page 13 is that this is not going to be a diatribe on contemporary issues, the dehumanization of medicine or whatever. And there are a lot of things. He's not saying that's wrong, although I think he's probably a bit tired of the culture warrior approach to Christian ethics, but he's simply saying that's not what he's up to in this book. And, of course, related to that is the fact that he is not going to be focusing on issues. Now, he will focus on some issues, but he's not going to begin by saying, okay, we're going to talk about abortion now. Is it right or wrong? Or we're going to talk about birth control. Is it right or wrong? What he's going to do is lay a foundation, and that's going to take up one-third of this course. It's going to be the next 3 or 4 weeks, the foundation of Christian ethics, so that then we can apply it to particular issues, and he's going to limit that to biotechnology at the beginning of life and at the end of life. But the foundations are oftentimes not really expanded and expounded in ways that he is going to do here. In fact, if I'm about to publish in Ordained Servant, you can look for it in March, a review of this book by Bill Edgar. He's a professor of apologetics and ethics at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. And he says, and he knows the field of ethics much better than I do, he said this is an utterly unique book within the field of Christian ethics. And it's unique because it is theological and it deals out of the whole of Christian character, that is to say, virtue. Now, in secular ethics, by the way, and secular counseling and psychology, there is a whole new move towards looking, rather than looking at aberrant behaviors, to looking at virtues, and which is very interesting to me because, of course, this is a supremely Christian endeavor. But Van Drunen is the first one to really pick up on this and put it into an ethical discourse that can be very helpful to us. One of the things that he is going to talk about then, the theological part, I guess you could find Christian ethics books that are going to bring theology into it. You can't write a book on ethics without doing that. But the idea that virtue, Christian virtue and character is central to decision-making, really helps us in terms of understanding the basic premise that we are only going to make good ethical decisions, whatever the question may be or the issue may be, if we are growing in virtue, in Christian virtue. So he talks about courage and hope and wisdom, all kinds of different character traits. And every human being, of course, has them. And our ethical decisions, for good or ill, come from our character, our sin, as well as those virtues that the Lord has given us, some by nature, by the way, and then others by especially by His grace. And so he makes the statement on page 15 that, to put it simply, those who wish to conduct themselves in an externally excellent way must strive to become internally excellent people. And that's I believe, that is the single greatest strength of this book and of his approach to ethics. Is, for example, someone is wrestling with an advanced stage of cancer on that same page. Is she a person of contentment, of courage, of hope? How do the presence or absence of these virtues bear upon her decision, determining both how she evaluates the attractions of each option and whether she will actually do what she determines is right? And so it's very important to appreciate this aspect of Christian decision-making. And then on the top of page 16, he makes the statement that many bioethical decisions, though, simply do not have an absolutely binding right or wrong answer. And see, this is related to the character thing, because it's going to, when we talk about Christian virtues, we're talking about the complexity of what a human being is. And then we're placing that person in their particular context, in their church, their family, the medical community, and so all decisions are not going to be black and white. And if that's one great thing you can take from this course, I think you'll find it to be very helpful and useful. And it's something that the broader Christian community in our day really needs to hear. And so he says that we're going to be considering bioethics issues in the context of the broader Christian life. Now, what are the theological foundations of this book? Because this is the other great strength of the book. He comes right out and says it there on page, I think it's the bottom of page 16. Where is he coming from theologically? Because you know. But he gets quite specific. And I like his answer. It's maybe more subtle and important than it might appear at first blush. Where is he coming from? What is his theological foundation? What he's saying is that I am a confessional Christian. That is to say, that I am part of a church that has confessions of faith. And interestingly, in our tradition, in the OPC, though we officially have the Westminster Standards, we also have always been very friendly to the three forms of unity, and the Heidelberg Catechism would be the one that's best known. In fact, our own G.I. Williamson has written not only his commentary on Westminster Confession and the catechisms, or the shorter catechism, but also on the Heidelberg Catechism. And so he's saying, I'm not doing this just from David Van Druyn's study. My foundation is in the Bible and in a long, rich history of interpreting the Bible in the visible church. This is such an important thing for us to grasp, the importance of being a confessional church and therefore of being a confessional ethicist. And he's really saying now all Christians need to be ethicists, not in the academic sense, but in the biblical sense, because we're interested by grace to live before God in a way that pleases him and is a blessing to those around us. And, of course, therefore, he says very clearly that his source of both Christian virtue and his theology is the Bible, as it's summarized by the confessions. Just as a quick reminder, like the metaphor when we think about confessions and why they're important in the church, of a map, a road map. No one would say, you know, that the map. I've got several of these books. The whole map of New Hampshire, of Maine, of Vermont, of Massachusetts, and it's great. You can find out where just about everything is on these maps. But you know, you look at the map and you don't know what the place actually looks like, but it gets you there. And so it doesn't It's not confused with the terrain. No one would say, because I saw Chichester on the map, that I've been to Chichester. But I can go to Chichester now. I have guidance. I'm not going to get lost trying to find Chichester. And so the confession helps us. It guides us through the actual terrain of the Bible, the terrain of God's Word. And so on page 17, he begins to lay out, and I've said it, but let me just repeat. The structure of the book is that we're going to be looking at foundations, and for the first, 5 weeks, and then we're going to have 7 weeks, six through 12, we'll be dealing with beginning of life and end of life issues. And notice week 10, I'll be adding something that I think is important, and especially this year has brought this to my attention. When we talk about end of life, we are going to do a kind of excursus on grief and how to grieve as Christians and how to relate to others who are grieving for the loss of a loved one. And so that's the general roadmap of the book. And so we go on page 23 then to the beginning of the foundations, and he calls his first chapter Christianity and Healthcare in a Fallen World. And there he reiterates the fact that there is a relationship of a believer's Christian commitment to his life in a broader and largely unbelieving world of health care. And so this brings up the question of how do we relate to secular bioethics? How do we relate to secular bioethics? I don't remember the commitment of the doctor or really even the ethicist, though I would assume the ethicist was a Roman Catholic when I did that in the mid-80s over at CMC. But the fact is that in every hospital there are ethicists, and they are often secular ethicists. And so how do we relate to this? And so there are five possibilities from his reading, Van Drunen's reading of books on ethics, and he is widely read, obviously, in the whole field, or he couldn't have written this book. He begins by looking at secular bioethics only. And so there you have writers who make morally serious arguments about bioethical issues for society as a whole and do so through a philosophical or pragmatic argumentation. In other words, it's non-theological, but it believes that there is a kind of common morality and that we're all going to be able to agree on that common morality. He gives a couple of examples of two people, Tom Beauchamp and James Childress, and he says that, you know, that their view is called principalism. And so another one, Robert Veach, that there's a kind of social contract or covenant among all members of society. Here, it's a little bit different. He's not saying so much that there's common ethics, but rather saying that we should try to agree on a common ethic. Well, of course, ever since Roe v. Wade, we've seen that we do not agree on a common ethic at all on those things that are very clear to Christians. And many non-Christians feel that their view is very clearly right on the exact opposite end of the spectrum. So what are the weaknesses of the secular bioethics approach only? What's the great weakness that just sort of is glaring here? Exactly. And you can't, and how can we possibly get a consensus? It's obvious that we just don't have a consensus in our nation on a bunch of different ethical issues. So then that's obviously not a place that we're going to go, although we're going to see that we still need to respect these writers, because there is a reason for that as Christians that we'll see in a moment. Then Christian bioethics only. See, the other opposite end of the spectrum is the idea that bioethics is derived solely from theological convictions, and it's a distinctively Christian approach to bioethics, and should control all healthcare practice. And so John Frame wrote a book called Medical Ethics. This actually is one that I read. It's been out for, I think he wrote this in the mid-80s, and I actually had his ethics course when I was at Westminster in Philadelphia. So this is certainly, it's a friendly ethicist, as it were, and yet he is taking a separatist approach to ethics, and saying that really it's only biblical absolutes need to be applied society-wide when it comes to ethical decision-making. And so what are the weaknesses of this Christian bioethics only? What would be a weakness that, and here we're entering into the answer to the question, is there a reason that Christians, a biblical reason, that Christians should respect and listen to and may even agree with secular ethicists? So what would be the weakness of a Christian-only bioethics? This is a little bit tougher one. Common grace and general or natural revelation. Now, some today are reviving interest in what's called natural law. I always thought that was a uniquely Roman Catholic understanding, and there's a way, of course, that can be abused, and yet what's interesting is that from Calvin on, all post-Reformation theologians dealing with ethics have always had the understanding that there is natural law, and because we live in God's world, that there's going to be wisdom that even non-Christians, even atheists, might bring to the ethical discussion that we need to listen for and respect and may even learn from. So then we have the third one would be secular and Christian bioethics are identical. And here there are a number of Roman Catholic bioethicists that hold to this position and basically believe that, in a sense, the Scripture simply sort of adds something to the authority or veracity of what's already there discovered in natural law. And so the two are really pretty much identical. And what would be the weakness of this approach? Ron?
I'm trying to take the church out of the public square.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're saying that the secular world is saying, when push comes to shove, coming to the same conclusions that we as Christians would come to. And so what it ends up doing is assuming that natural law is clear to everyone and coming, as Rome does, from a semi-Pelagian view. It's not, in other words, total depravity is not understood in the way that we would as Calvinists and believe that the Bible teaches that we're totally depraved, that is to say, every dimension of our human lives, including our intellects and our moral reasoning, is colored by sin. And so the potential for corruption there is tremendous. And so natural law in and of itself is not going to give us, as Christians, it's not going to give us all that we need to know, because even our own sin will corrupt our moral reasoning. And so that ends up being then not an approach that Van Drunen believes we should be taking. Then a fourth would be secular and Christian bioethics are radically different. And so you have someone like the Eastern Orthodox ethicist named Engelhardt, who takes this view, and he takes a very pessimistic view of the possibility of genuine moral discourse in a pluralistic secular society. I think that's what you were just saying, Ron, that, you know, the church is, they're just so diametrically opposed, the church and the world and its ethics, that there really can't be much of a dialogue at all. And I think, again, here, this would be a denial of the presence of common grace, even in a post-moral, a post-modern and relativistic context. Now, of course, this all remains to be proven, but where Van Drunen is going to be coming from then is that secular bioethics and Christian bioethics are distinct, but both legitimate, and they need to interact. So it's not to say that non-Christian or secular bioethics is going to be right on everything. And on some things it may be egregiously wrong, but it means that a dialogue between the two is something that we should be willing to engage in. And so the weakness of this is not so much a weakness, it's just that what we have to face then is if we believe that common grace gives unbelievers wisdom in different areas of life, certainly medicine is one of those areas, then we have to interact. We have to relate in the public square to those questions. We have to go into that room where we have to make a decision over someone's life, let's say at the end of life, and talk with the priest, the secular ethicist, and the doctor, who is in a sense an ethicist who may or may not be a Christian. And we've got to be willing to engage in that conversation as believers. Now, what he does with the remainder of this introduction, this introductory chapter, is that he takes this distinct but legitimate view, and he wants to simply make a case for the fact that everyone is made in the image of God. Okay, and so yes, sin has corrupted unbelievers. And it still works in our own souls to color our reasoning in some negative ways. But the fact is that we're all made in God's image. We share this with the unbeliever. And so, made in his image. Then, of course, the fall divides humanity into the two cities of Augustine, so that there are two cities, the city of man and the city of God, that are definitely in conflict with one another, have very different destinies, have very different objects of worship, and yet we live together in a mixed situation. The only time that that was not true was in ancient Israel. When there was a land, there was a king, and there was a law. It was all of a piece. The whole of the reality was under God. But that's a unique setting, a unique situation in history. And before that, the patriarchs, and after that, all of the New Testament era, we are mixed in with the world, and God in his common grace continues to bless that world. Calvin even says, by gifting through the power of his Spirit all of the unbelievers in the world to give us civil government that, while not perfect, keeps basic human order. Even in a place as difficult as Haiti, there's some human order there, and it's in God's providence that that takes place. And so in medicine, the ability to discover the genome system and the ability to have various cures and things that are extending human life and making human life not as difficult in some ways as it was before. All of this is simply a reminder that God has gifted unbelievers as well as believers in this world, and we're told to live in this world, to seek the peace like the children of Israel in exile of the world in which we live, of the city of Babylon in the case of Jeremiah 29. And so he ends then this chapter by saying that bioethics is therefore a common task, and that we have good reason to respect the views of those who are secularists in the medical profession and in the ethical profession, and that we need to enter into a genuine dialogue to understand how it is that we are to behave in certain areas. And, of course, what we need to really ask at a certain point in this discussion, and he gives us the answer, is this a biblical view? Is this biblical? And what does he give for an answer to that? Where? Because he says yes, otherwise he wouldn't be writing this book in a seminary. But what are some of the scriptures that he gives to show that that natural law functions in the unbeliever to give a sense of right and wrong, and that we are to engage in life in this world with unbelievers? What are some of the scriptures that he gives? And this is a final question, and these will be final answers. So Romans 1 and 2, let me just read one, especially 2, verses 14 and 15. Now, this is a controversial passage, and you know how I preached this back last year, or the year before, actually. But here's what it says. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. Now, there he's talking about the written law of Moses. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or excuse them on the day, and then it talks about the day of judgment. So, but here's the point, is that even the worst sinner has a moral dialogue going on within him or herself, and so there is a knowledge of what's right and wrong there, even though sin will often lead to the wrong conclusions. And that's why, as we have a distinct ethic, so we're going to be bringing our biblical understanding of what's right and wrong into the equation, but we're going to also realize that unbelievers we can meet them on common ground in many instances. And so that's the conclusion that he comes to, and we're out of time. And if you want to talk more about this, I mean, this is, you know, this whole question of common grace and natural law are questions that are being hotly debated now within the Reformed community, and these are things that we can talk about. But this is the basis in any case, and we'll begin to look at chapter 2 of Foundations next week.